The upcoming presentation is a two-man power trip of wrestling podcast production.
Let's get it going right here, right now. This is New Generation Declassified, and you're listening to an all-new New Generation Declassified here, exclusively on the Two-Man Power Trip of Wrestling's podcasting empire. If you didn't know by now, my name is Chad, and every single week, we take a journey back in time. We go back and look at the finer days of the World Wrestling Federation's New Generation era, the mid-90s. Some might call it the dark days. Some might call it the glory days. But we'll figure out what the guest thinks today as I'm joined by, from the Shining Wizards podcast, my longtime close personal friend, Mr. Kevin, joining me today. Kevin, I mean, we connected after what, 3-4 months?
Yeah, man, it's been a while. I believe we did the Front Row Material podcasting roundtable.
And yes, that was, yes.
And that was awesome with some other great, talented podcast hosts. And now we're back doing something together, and I couldn't be more excited about it.
Well, that's very cool to hear. Yeah, we did a podcast symposium with Front Row Material, the great Mike Freeland, quite possibly the nicest person in podcasting. If he bestowed any kind of merit or any kind of distinction, it's to be the nicest guy in podcasting, which is very rare. But we tend to lean on that side, too, so we'll go with that.
Couldn't agree more. The guy doesn't seem like he has a bad bone in his body, so there's that.
Yeah, no, he's a good dude. He's been on the show a couple of times. He's got a great take on things. And this show, you know, whether, you know, you've listened to it religiously, like I know you probably have, or not. So for the or not, I'll give you a review of what we usually do on the program. What we do is we sit here from the fan perspective of, we were fans then, we are fans now. Does this stuff hold up? Is it better? Is it worse? Is the critical response to the New Generation era accurate? Or just because we were growing up during that time, is it just as awesome as we remember? So that's what we're going to get into today. Are you ready for that?
I am, man. There's a lot to unpack in the New Generation. So I'm excited to see where this goes, man.
So let's start with first things first, and that is, what were you doing during this era? Where were you at in terms of being a fan? Now, obviously, you're a Northeast guy like myself. We lived on the WWF. That was our home base. That was our home territory. So we definitely digested a lot of what the WWF had to offer. But where were you at as a fan in the mid-90s?
All right, so mid-90s, if you want to say, I guess, the New Generation kind of unofficially rolled out in maybe 1993.
Yep.
If you want to say that. So I was 10 years old. So deep into wrestling fandom, deep into WWF, but now just at the age where you can actually start comprehending what you're seeing.
Right.
So, you know, obviously my favorite era is 90, 89, 91, that sort of thing. But this is just where you get to the point where you can actually understand what you're seeing and dissect characters and appreciate characters or not appreciate characters. So I was right in that meaty part of your childhood fandom.
And that's perfect, because that's exactly the way I look at it too, is, you know, even though I fell in love with the Hogan era, Hogan, Piper, Savage, Warrior, Mr. Perfect, Ravishing Rick Rude, you know, everybody from that era, Bundy, Stud, Andre, you love those guys. This was the era for our age group to like really get entrenched. So we read the magazines. We saw all the stories. We watched all the Coliseum videos. We religiously sat to the TV every single Saturday and Sunday for our wrestling consumption. But we were just starting to kind of get what was going on. And this era, which is much maligned as not a successful era, was really the one where we were like, this is the greatest thing going. What are you talking about?
Yeah, it was such a weird time because everything became different. Like everything that you thought you knew about wrestling, like changed. Like all the characters, the pageantry, while it was always there to an extent, completely changed. The colors, the sets, the pyro, just the type of characters that you saw, good, bad, or indifferent, completely the rule book was thrown out and you were getting a little bit of absolutely everything.
So what was your go-to during this era? Who was your new generation guy?
All right, so if we're going directly from the 93, 94, obviously it's Brett. Brett, I mean, he's been around since the 80s, but just this new world champion main event, super fancy leather jacket, sunglasses, world champion Brett. Brett was my guy, and he still is to this day. So, yeah, I got to go. If I have to pick one, it's Bret Hart all the way.
Yeah, I tend to agree, and kind of the same exact sentiment. You know, Bret was there. He was an established guy to us already, was already a tag champion, you know, winning matches, and he's the Intercontinental champion. But now as, like, the leader, it was understandable. You could get behind it. But what we talk about on this show is we drop the new generation era. We break it down into the top five guys.
Ooh. And
Bret, Shawn, Diesel, Undertaker, Razor Ramon. Okay. Would you feel that that's an appropriate five to represent this era?
All right. So we said Bret, Shawn, Razor, Diesel, Taker.
Yes.
I would say yes. I think they define the new generation. But if you want to, like, get into the weeds about it, like, I feel like you got to have. You got to have Yokozuna somewhere in there.
Okay.
But I think just when you picture the new generation, you picture those five guys 100%.
Yeah, you picture those five guys. Obviously, Lex Luger not on that list too. So it wasn't everybody. We can't take everybody into that top five. But those are the five guys that when you think of, hey, this era, all right, that's those are basically the leaders in the clubhouse. But, you know, a guy like Shawn Michaels, another guy that... And you're from New Jersey, correct?
Yes, sir.
You would know during that era, Shawn Michaels, albeit a babyface, was not very liked in the New York metro area. He got booed out of a lot of buildings. So I look at it from the, yes, Bret was there during that heyday, but so was Shawn Michaels. But why was Bret loved so much over Shawn?
I guess it's because no one liked the arrogance that Shawn Michaels protruded. And in our area in New York and New Jersey, like if you like walked around like that with like chaps and stuff, like you were like the tough guys would want to hurt you. Like it's just the way it was. And I feel like that's why. And plus a lot. And part of it's got to be jealousy too. Like he was the guy that all your girls, like you're bringing your girl to see a wrestling show, but they're there to see Shawn Michaels. So it's got to be a little bit of that, at least off the top of my head. That's what I can guess in terms of being booed out of the building. But man, I remember going to shows at the Meadowlands like consistently throughout this era. And just because I was a Bret guy, but I never hated Shawn Michaels.
Right.
Possibly because I think a part of me always appreciated the Rockers. So I don't think that ever went away.
Okay. Can't you? Rockers,
that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. It does. No, the Rockers were great. And we would see the other Rocker, Marty Jannetty, pop in and out during the new generation era. Talked about him on last week's show. But yes, I've talked about it many times. The Northeast was not kind to Shawn Michaels, albeit he was popular. He was over. He was Intercontinental and World Champ during this era and Tag Champ during this era. But when he got the top spot, and this is why I wanted to ask you this, because you are a Jersey guy like myself. I mean, you couldn't walk around with those red sunglasses and the gloves and the Shawn Michaels beeper hat and think that you weren't going to get a pounding. Not because it's wussy. It just wasn't cool. It was very lame.
like the leather motorcycle hat, like or whatever. Like you can't wear that to school. Like
you're risking your... with a pink Bret Hart shirt and glasses over the Shawn Michaels zebra village people hat.
you're not getting away with wearing a heart no pun intended, Bret Hart, but Shawn Michaels had the heart shaped sunglasses. At least Bret Hart sunglasses you might be able to get away with because they were either silver or like pink and metallic. Shawn Michaels were legit red hearts, as lenses. So yeah, you're not walking into fifth grade dodgeball, not getting pounded.
You'd be a great target if you had the Shawn Michaels glasses on. They look like they could be sold at Claire's in the mall. You know, you go to like the Claire's store to get your ears pierced, and you see the Shawn Michaels glasses.
And it's so funny. Not like 2 years later, I'm walking around in like because I guess like kind of like corduroy and hippie stuff in the grunge era was like right after this. So like now, like you're walking around with like shaded sunglasses like Shawn Michaels had, but again, just not heart shaped.
Ridiculous. It's so ridiculous looking back. But I was thinking about for this week, you know, last week I talked about the top moments of the new generation era. Just trying to think. I always like to think outside the box. Okay. Either we stick to a topic or we look kind of run down a card or something. But I kind of got stuck on one thing in my head, and it was debuts during this era. And I posed that to you. You had a couple great ideas. But the thing about the debut that I kind of want to clarify is I don't mean it's just like, you know, so-and-so's WWF debut. It's like, no. When they arrived, was their arrival impactful, and did it have like a long-lasting tenure to it? You know, was it like, hey, yeah, we remember when Jean-Pierre Lafitte, he debuted, but he was Pierre a year and a half ago. I don't mean that one. You know, I don't mean somebody like rebranded. I mean, like, they arrived in the WWF and their impact was such that it had an absolutely long lasting life in not just right. the WWF world, but the wrestling world. So I'm going to ask you to dig back into the annals of your brain for this one, as we kind of look at some of the new generation debuts.
All right. So one immediately comes to mind, and that is Goldust.
That's a great one. Yes. What do you remember about the Goldust debut? So now Goldust debut has the vignette starting to run towards the end of the summer, 95 into the fall. I believe he makes his debut at the October In Your House against Bam Bam Bigelow, I want to say. Or Marty or Bam Bam. I don't have it in front of me.
I think it's Jannetty. It's Jannetty.
Damn, Jannetty gets the shaft again. But what do you remember about Goldust and the Goldust debut?
I remember being confused. it's so weird because, like, I don't know, like, if it was just I was so diehard. I'm like, this guy looks familiar to me. Like, he doesn't, but he does. And then, like, you know, after a while, you see, you know, what is he? Is he just supposed to be a human Oscar award? What is he supposed to be? And then, like, you know, eventually you figure out who he is, and it's just it never mattered who he was prior.
Right.
That's how good this character was. Like, once you figured it out, it didn't matter. And you figured it out and you moved on, and you just lived with Goldust as Goldust. And I remember it being creepy, but I remember it having a lot of legs. Pairing him obviously with Mankind at some point was bizarre, but to me it worked.
A little bit of a stretch,
but I didn't hate it because they're both weird dudes, and Mankind's another one you could throw on that memorable debut type list.
We'll come back to him. We don't want to take anything away from Goldust. I'm going to cut you off because I remember when the vignette started to air, and look, I wasn't a dedicated observer or Pro Wrestling Torch subscriber at the time. No. I mean, did I call the not just the 900 hotlines, but, you know, some of those freebie 800 lines that would pop up? Yes. But I had somebody tell me that's Dustin Rhodes. And I was like, no, there's no way it is. And they go, Dusty Rhodes had a character, Stardust. And I was like, yeah, that's great. But this is not Dustin Rhodes. I've seen Dustin Rhodes. I know what he looks like.
Yeah,
this is not him, because when he comes out, it's not the refined Goldust character we know to grow and love. It's a different one. He's a little heavier.
Yeah.
And the like you said, the human Oscar come to life. He is fully draped in gold, complete. You can't see any bit of his hair. You can't see the back of his neck. He's fully covered in gold, and he didn't have definition to the makeup where you could say, I could tell, because no, he was just like a golden man, like gold member from Austin Powers. And you couldn't tell it was Dustin Rhodes until he took the wig off, he took the jacket off, and the paint started to wear down. And then you're like, oh, okay, I can see it was him. Were you surprised when you found out it was Dustin Rhodes?
Oh, 100%, I was surprised. I don't remember how I found out. I don't know if I put it together myself or if, like you said, I wasn't reading The Observer, I wasn't doing the Torch, I wasn't calling the numbers. I don't remember how I found out, but I know I found out. And like I said, I was shocked because this is not the natural that I remembered.
No.
And it was completely different. So well done. And so, like, so again, the narrative, so new, like something that we've never seen before. Like, at least I haven't as a 10, 11-year-old kid. Never seen such an androgynous type Hollywood-esque fancy character before, completely reshifted how, you know, a wrestler was presented.
He debuts at my personal favorite In Your House, and I'm saying that facetiously because my buddy the Dean wins the Intercontinental Championship for about 8 minutes on this show. But Goldust debuts at In Your House number 4 in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, October 22nd, 1995, defeating Marty Jannetty with the curtain call after blocking the fist drop off the top rope from Marty Jannetty. So there you go. You were right. It was Marty, because Bam Bam was Survivor Series. So a clever way to bring in a guy like Goldust, who's going to beat these established guys. But Bam Bam was out the door. Jannetty yeah. still there. So I kind of wonder why they beat him so fast.
Yeah, that is weird. I guess it's probably just the whole, like, and again, I know this is more of like a friendly, like shoot the stuff conversation, but maybe just because the better match would have been with Jannetty.
Right. Maybe. Yes. Very true.
So, That's the only thing I can think of. And plus, like, Jannetty was his job then, you know? And like you said, he was in and out a million times in this era. So it just kind of made sense to me.
And then how about this? The next night, Goldust makes his, technically the next night. It wouldn't air until the following week, the 30th, 1995. Goldust defeats Savio Vega in 8 minutes with an armbar into a cradle for his Raw debut to get the win. Again, Savio Vega, guy with a lot of momentum in that point in 95. He gets beat by Goldust second night in the company.
Yeah, and that just shows you what they had planned for this guy. Like, they believed in it, and they went with it. So you gotta respect that, man.
Let's stay with Savio for a second. Savio Vega debuts this past summer in 95. He debuts around, I believe, May, at the In Your House pay-per-view. It might have been the first In Your House. And again, do we know him from somewhere? He looks a little bit familiar, but I can't put my finger on it. My mind was blown to find out that he was Quang less than a year earlier with a face mask and the green mist. But Savio Vega had a pretty impactful debut because he had a really good spot as an undercard babyface for a good 2 to 3 years before they, you know, turned him into a Barriqua. But he absolutely, I would put him in the memorable debut column for what this era represents.
100% comes in. I believe he saves Razor Ramon from a beatdown from Jeff Jarrett and the Roadie.
Yep.
And so he's billed as this fan, like Razor Ramon's friend from Cuba or something that.
It's very dumb. Of course, some stupid logic by management, but yes.
But dude, that's talk about like you said, Quang, like. I don't think people realize how long Quang was a thing. Like,
yeah.
He was around for like a good year and a half run. And then shows up like this and immediately paired with arguably one of the hottest stars of the new generation. He's on the top five of Razor Ramon. That's a heck of a spot to be placed right into.
Yeah. So it's May 14th, 1995 In Your House number 1. At the On Center in Syracuse, New York, a miraculous 7,000 people attending this In Your House number 1. At the conclusion of the match, Razor Ramon is saved by his longtime friend, Savio Vega. This is Savio Vega's debut. Nobody knew who he was. Once you saw and put together it was Quang, you go, oh, okay, I get it now. Yeah, same tights, same build, same look, no mask, no mist.
Yeah, you know what? I think it took me a lot longer to put the Savio Quang connection together than it did the Goldust Dustin Rhodes connection.
you just found it out 5 minutes ago. That's why.
Yeah. I what? Wait. What?
Quang? Are you serious?
What's a Quang?
Oh my gosh! Yeah. No, Savio Vega, great from the babyface side, and ironically, you know, in feuding with Goldust, they would have a trade-off about a year later, a televised switcheroo of the Intercontinental title that would then be switched back without, you know, referee official decision. So kind of interesting. We would use those two guys to start. And again, didn't really rehearse this, didn't really go off. This is the nature of the show. You kind of just go off the top of your head and see what sticks. Because I wouldn't even have thought Savio Vega going into it, but the more you put it together, boom, he's now on the list.
Yeah. And Savio's like one of these guys who, like, you're surprised, like, other than that IC title thing that you mentioned, which I guess no one ever really counts. I'm shocked that he never won at least I can't think of. He never won a championship there.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't think he even won the, you know, the $1 million championship, did he? Where they with Austin, you know, when they were bantying that belt about. He did not, but I'll tell you, at the Great Meadowlands, you know, our home base for matches in the 90s, I saw a great Savio Vega Gold Dust Intercontinental title match, and it had about the nearest of near falls you could have, where everybody in that arena thought that he won the Intercontinental Championship and went nuts. And when they said it was a two, oh my God, I think Goldust rolled him up like right after that.
what did you think of the gear that Savio wore? Just like jeans and like a cutoff shirt.
Yeah, it was, you know, it worked. If he was just supposed to be, you know, like a guy who escaped from Cuba, you know, to help his buddy Razor Ramon, you know, I think it worked because it was different. You know, what was he going to do? Come out in, you know, a singlet and, you know, wrestling tights.
Yeah,
because Quang's attire didn't have the jeans, but it had a similar look to it. So, you know, he's in like black jeans and that red Savio Vega cutoff. I don't know. I liked it. I thought it worked.
Yeah. And the Quang gear literally had it seemed like it had no thought put into it whatsoever. No. singlet top and windbreaker pants and a mask they found probably just in props.
Yeah, now that was a bad one. That was like, you know, they had a couple from Mr. X laying around. They're like, that's Quang's mask now. Give that one to Quang over there. But how about, let's say too, Savio's still going. Savio is not slowed down. He's worked in MLW over the last year.
That's right. Yeah, he's been in some pretty high profile matches with MLW, and I'm sure he still runs a lot of stuff in his home base in Puerto Rico or Cuba, right? No, Puerto Rico,
but Cuba just because, you know.
Yeah, but Cuba was gimmicked from Cuba, right?
They said he was the Caribbean when he debuted. They weren't specific. They just said the Caribbean.
Okay, so maybe I'm wrong about the whole Cuba thing.
No, it was because Razor's from Cuba. He's supposed to be Cuban.
Okay.
So no, it was just he was an unnamed, unlike assigned Caribbean savior for one Razor Ramon.
Caribbean savior.
Yeah. I mean, what else can you say, right?
You're right.
That's what he was. He saved the day. He's a savior. You mentioned before Mankind. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this is a great one because I would consider this to be not the tail end of what I like to say the New Generation era, but like three quarters of the way through. But from when he had those first vignettes debut in, I believe, December 95, all the way to when he debuted around WrestleMania, nobody knew what the hell to think of what it was. If you knew the ear and you knew the voice, you knew it was Cactus Jack, but we did not know what Mankind was and what Mankind had to offer. What are your memories of first seeing the Mankind debut vignettes?
I had no idea what to expect. Like at least like with Goldust, you understood like, all right, Hollywood guy, you know, androgynous, this and that. Like Mankind, like tortured soul, like mommy, like all this weird stuff. Like I had no clue about what this was supposed to be. And I don't even think we ever really found out
mommy wasn't really explored much. He would call Goldust mommy that summer,
and I think Sable too at one point, right?
Yeah, but I don't think the mommy thing and the playing of the piano and then all that stuff, I don't really think that was ever really explored.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because I know it's probably been mentioned on a million different other podcasts, but he was like the only guy that had a different music leaving than he did coming in.
Yes, correct. He had that very plotting and very mysterious entrance music, and then leaving was the piano playing that, you know, the mandible claw was really a piece of the piano playing that they would kind of talk about in the vignettes. But yes, why did he have two different musics, but then never really explore it afterwards? It was just like, oh yeah, entrance and exit, that's it.
Yeah, and it's so strange that I mean at least that I don't remember it ever being explained, but like it didn't, again, it like Goldust, it didn't matter because it just worked. Like you put him right into a feud with, I think his first like one, I know Undertaker came, but I think Jake the Snake or Henry Godwin may have been his first like high profile thing. I know he had a couple matches with like Bob Holly because he put like the mandible claw on somebody and Bob Holly tried to get him off or something like that. And it's just crazy how quickly he, you know, elevated up the card.
Yeah, well, he makes his debut. Jake was attacked by Mankind. It was the Monday Night Raw after WrestleMania 12. So it really wasn't. It was Mark Mero who made the save.
Okay.
On Jake. You know, on paper, that would have worked as a kickoff feud for Mankind, but Mankind's TV debut was officially on that Raw as well. He attacks, he beats Bob Holly with the mandible claw, but the Jake thing never really materialized, where you would think on paper that really would be a catalyst for a huge run for a guy like Mankind.
I think he was supposed to have a match against Jake the Snake Roberts, and it ended up being Henry Godwin ended up having to take Jake the Snake's place for whatever reason. I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure they were supposed to have a match at it in your house or some sort of pay-per-view. Maybe it was King of the Ring. But yeah, and then Henry Godwin ends up replacing it. So I would have loved to see a one-on-one Mankind Jake Roberts match, even though this is like 95, 96 Jake Roberts.
Yeah.
But still.
It must have been something with Raw, because I'm just scanning through as we're talking. I'm not seeing Jake Roberts and Ahmed Johnson take on Davey Boy Smith and Owen Hart at the next In Your House. And then the following In Your House is the May In Your House with the Blackout, where we would see Mankind come out of the casket at the end of the Undertaker, the match, and Jake Roberts pins Bradshaw with a roll up around the 32nd mark.
I think this might be, the International Incident pay per view.
Okay, all right, that's fast forwarding. Yeah, that's
much that's going in the time machine, hopping forward a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. But still, we knew Cactus Jack. We didn't know Dude Love. We didn't know Mankind. We didn't know Mick Foley. We knew Cactus Jack. Were you disappointed to not see Cactus Jack in the WWF?
No, I wasn't. I was never, like, I knew exactly who Cactus Jack. Believe it or not, I watched Cactus Jack more in, like, I think global wrestling than I did in WCW, even though in like 94, 95, his stuff with Max Payne and Kevin Sullivan, I really enjoyed. But I think I remember Cactus Jack from his days with, like, it was like him and Scotty Polo or Johnny Flamingo and Rip Rogers as like some sort of tandem in global championship wrestling.
Yeah.
A global wrestling federation.
Yes.
And so I remember him from that. So I was never super invested in the Cactus Jack character. Not that there's anything wrong with it. He's one of the greatest characters of all time, but it just, I wasn't disappointed. I don't think. Were you?
I'm half and half, only because I was watching him in ECW before he debuted as Mankind. And okay. I loved end of ECW Cactus Jack. So as much as I did enjoy Cactus Jack earlier in, you know, 92-ish, I didn't really love the Sullivan, Max Payne, Nasty Boy. Like, I didn't like any of that stuff. That wasn't a favorite era. I loved either like 91, 92 Cactus Jack or ECW Cactus Jack. So I was a little disappointed, and I didn't really know what to think of just this weird character. It didn't really jump off the page to me, so I was a little underwhelmed, I have to admit. I mean, great in retrospect, but I was definitely I would rather have seen Cactus Jack get a WWF run.
Yeah, totally fair. And I, of course, obviously later on we all know that he would have one hell of a run as Cactus Jack.
Oh, absolutely. I was there that night. I was just talking about that to somebody
at the Rumble in 2000. When he came back as Cactus Jack.
When he came back in 97 on Raw at MSG.
That was an MSG show? Because I was at SummerSlam 97 when
he ripped the shirt open?
Yeah. Yeah, I was there for that. But he was Mankind then.
Right. Now, the crazy MSG Raw, September 97, actually my birthday, September 97, quite possibly one of my favorite, if not the favorite show I've ever been to, because it was just filled to the brink with amazing moments. Austin stuns McMahon. The dark match was a triple threat with Undertaker, Shawn Michaels, and Bret Hart. That's the show where the Brooklyn Brawler wins the Battle Royal to take on Shawn Michaels at the next pay-per-view or next Garden House show. I mean, just like, it was filled with moments, but Cactus Jack's debut is the one that stands out the most.
Yeah, it's a great debut. I think I was too young to still go to New York for wrestling shows.
Oh, we went in with you know, Buddy's dad, his company had tickets. How many people went to wrestling shows the same way? Somebody's dad had tickets, you would go with him, and that's how you.
I think, You know what's so strange? You know, it's no, you're right. And like when I got into high school, I started, for some reason, I don't think I ever even pictured Madison Square Garden as a destination because I didn't realize how close I actually was to MSG. Like it never computed in my head. And my dad, while he appreciated wrestling, he wasn't a fan enough to go out of his way to say, "Hey, let's go to the Garden."
Right.
Like it would be like, "Hey dad, can we go to the Meadowlands?" And be like, "Yeah, no problem." But the Garden never computed with me at that time. I went to a million shows at the Garden in my late teens and early 20s. And since then,
my dad hated wrestling. I never went to wrestling. I don't know why. It was okay. I had it on TV. I was perfectly fine with that. The tons of shows that they'd even run locally where we lived in Jersey was, it's very sad looking back. A young Chadster would have really enjoyed some of the
got the Garden.
Yeah, definitely would have enjoyed some of it without a doubt. But I digress. I love the Meadowlands. I absolutely loved it. It was my favorite place to watch shows. So there's nothing wrong with the Meadowlands. At any stretch, I would never say that. It's nothing wrong with Meadowlands.
Right. Absolutely not.
Two more I want to cover before we wrap up, because I know you got to get back to work. We have two things that we have. Last week's top moment in the countdown that I had, I polled people. The results were in. The top moment of the New Generation era is the 1-2-3 Kid defeats Razor Ramon. Would you agree with that?
I would 100% agree that that is definitely, and that won the poll.
That was, yeah, I sent out just a random text messages to people and said, "Hey, what do you think the top moments were of the New Generation era?" Some were, you know, came back ridiculous, some whatever, but every person nearly had that on their return text to me.
That was one of those that you know what, you're 100% right, that because that was like, oh my god, like what did I just see? Like that like was the catalyst probably to the new generation, that moment.
Anything can happen. A job guy who we've only seen for a few weeks, although if you knew who he was, you weren't surprised. You were kind of like, why is he losing every week? I mean, when he finally did get the win, you knew that the Lightning Kid with the complete Lightning Kid tights was somebody, but you know, when he beat Razor Ramon, I was shocked. Now I covered it last week, so I don't want to beat it over the head. But were you a 1-2-3 Kid fan during this era?
100%. I remember him again from Global as Lightning Kid. I remember him, and I remember Kamikaze Kid, Cannonball Kid.
Yes,
you know, Kid. Like, and then
we'll get him a name, Kid. You know,
So yeah, I loved him.
Yeah, he was great. I was definitely I was all on board with the 1-2-3 Kid. So we went over that last week. So I'm not going to beat it to death. It's May 1993. He debuts a couple weeks earlier. So that was the other little thing. He debuts about 3.5 weeks earlier, and he loses to Doink in his first match. Now the match had to be done twice. Now I don't know if that was because it was bad or because he was good. That's the thing I would love to figure out.
Ooh, that's a great question. No idea.
Right? I mean, you don't think Matt Bourne and Sean Waltman are going to have a bad match as it is, but maybe they had no expectations for it and saw, wait a second, this kid's got something.
Yeah, and at this point, you're still trying to get Doink over, so you can't have this you know, quote-unquote job guy getting too much on Doink, I guess, right?
I would 100% agree. So, go back, check that out. I want to just cover this last one before we say goodbye, because this is one that you did not mention. And this was the catalyst for this episode. And this is why I'm curious to hear your take on it. So this is the debut to me that stands out the most as it relates to the New Generation era. Okay. We're going to go back to July 25th, 1993. Okay. Alexandria Bay, New York, at the Castle Recreation Center. Do you even know where that is?
No idea. Not even going to try to guess.
I'm sure way north. Let's just say that. It sounds okay. Like it would be way north. On that night, they taped a few episodes of Monday Night Raw, as they normally would. This would be the lead into SummerSlam, about a month away at this point. In this venue... See, you like the dramatic build?
Oh, yeah.
On the August 2nd, 1993 edition of Raw that was taped that night, Jim Cornette makes his WWF debut in a segment where he just innocuously shows up in ring while Bobby Heenan has to jump in and start interviewing him.
Oh, I remember this. Bobby Heenan goes nuts when Jim Cornette, he's like, "Do you know who that is? Yeah. Do you know?" Yeah.
Cornette just appears at ringside. Bobby Heenan pops up from his chair, goes into the ring, and you have in the middle of the ring in the WWF, probably the two top managers of the 1980s, face-to-face in a WWF ring with the endorsement of a lifetime coming out of Bobby Heenan to Jim Cornette. What were your memories of Jim Cornette's arrival, and were you surprised to see him in the WWF?
It was just that, like Bobby Heenan going absolutely bonkers, just like, do you know who that man is? Like, I'm not going to try to do a Bobby Heenan impersonation, but jumping in the ring, giving him a big hug. And now is Jim Cornette by himself here, or do the Heavenly Bodies pop up here too?
Jim Cornette is by himself at this point.
Okay.
So they're going to start the build to bring in the Heavenly Bodies to take on the Steiners at SummerSlam. He is not yet the spokesman for Yokozuna. And I mentioned that being just a few weeks out from SummerSlam because, I mean, they're recording this July 25th. SummerSlam, I think it's like August 23rd or 24th or something. So they're really knocking on the door of this huge event. But no, he issues a challenge to the Steiner brothers on behalf of the Heavenly Bodies at this show.
Yeah, I loved it. I remember it now. Like it's really triggering back like actual memories, not just like I watched it on the network memories, like actually watching it live memories, which was incredible because, you know, you saw Jim Cornette dangerous. Oh, no, that was Paul Heyman, but I know you saw Jim Cornette with, you know, Midnight Express and all that stuff. And just him showing up was just, oh, it was incredible.
An unbelievable run, would become the American spokesman for Yokozuna, would form Camp Cornette with the Bulldog, Owen, Vader. Great roster of guys that he would manage along the way. Now there's a couple stinkers.
Yeah.
He technically did manage Mantar. So not everything, but still, when you think about the pantheon of WWF and the fact that they've basically all but forgotten Cornette, this is something that you have to look at the meeting of the two territories, the NWA, WCW and the WWF. This was a guy who I legit never would have pictured in the WWF while he was in, you know, the NWA and WCW.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Totally did not fit the managerial. I mean, I guess he did, but like just not.
I don't want to take that word. Sorry to interrupt from him of saying he's too Southern, but even though he's cartoony and he's got the pants and the suits and the racket, I just don't see him in the WWF. So for this, I think it's just such a big thing to have the endorsement of the guy who was the top manager in that company for 10 years to a guy like Jim Cornette, who would then, you know, obviously he'd have a great run in the WWF for the next 6 or 7 years, a staple randomly in this 1,000 seat attending arena in Alexandria Bay, New York at the Castle Recreation Center. The legendary Jim Cornette, the Louisville Lip, debuts in the WWF.
Oh, perfect.
So that's how we will close it out. There's more. We could go on forever. We did not mention Lex Luger. You know, we did not mention other guys. You know, even you got. Ahmed, give me a wrap.
Ahmed Johnson, Mark Merrow, Mark Henry, Adam Baum,
Dean Douglas.
Dean Douglas, of course. Buddy Landell.
Yeah. So there's a ton of them, right? Yeah, exactly. Buddy Landell replacing Dean Douglas.
Yeah.
On one show. So yeah, there's a ton more. I would love to have you back if you want to talk about this or anything else again. I know we kind of got a time crunch because of when we're recording this, but yeah. I really love going down memory lane and picking out, like I said, a couple I didn't even think of to start this off. But nonetheless, you did miss that on this show, this same Monday Night Raw, the Macho Midget also debuts.
Oh God, I remember that like it was yesterday too. Unbelievable.
Freaky, the Macho Midget. Very weird.
Yes. Yes. It was way too lifelike. That.
Yes, it was. All right, Kevin. But before we say goodbye, please share with the listeners of New Generation Declassified where they can find you, the Shining Wizards, and your stand-up comedy and everything else that you got going on in your world.
Yeah, the Shining Wizards Wrestling Podcast at Wizards Podcast across all social media platforms. I am at Kevin Garifo on Twitter, at Shining Wizards Kevin on Instagram. We just had Mickey James on the show last night, so I'm very excited about that. I met your friend Francine over the weekend up in Baltimore, Boston for the Major Wrestling Figure podcast. So that
did
was
you tell her you know me?
I did. I did name drop you. Nice. I did name drop you. She's a sweetheart.
Yeah, that's great.
So yeah, I told her I was going to be doing the show today. So yeah, it was great. let's see, I just finished up a bunch of shows, so I'm constantly booking comedy. Once 100%, it's ready to do so. So I'm looking forward to that. And I want to thank you, Chad, for having me on. It was so much fun.
Absolutely. Hey, I just want to ask you one question about the comedy before we say goodbye. Did you do any virtual comedy shows while everybody was locked down and none of the clubs were open?
No, I refused.
Okay, because those things seem so awkward. I can't imagine it.
Yeah, I get nervous enough, like being live, like just doing it in a completely new format. No, I would have died.
Because you just gotta what if everybody's muted, by accident, and you have this killer joke that you're like, this is the whole basis of my act, and then there's silence, and you're like, I'm gonna just quit the business now. I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah, I have way too many of those moments in real life. I don't need to do it in a pandemic.
All right. Well, for me, it's at Chad EMB on Twitter. It's at IB Exclusives on Instagram. One Mr. Garifo just got a follow about 30 minutes ago.
And I followed you back, my friend.
I saw while we were recording. I'm trying to expand that platform from my sports memorabilia business, which you can find at IBExclusives.com. I have a couple wrestling signings up there as we speak and a big one that's going to be announced this week. So please stay tuned to that. And all these podcasts are on TMPTEmpire.com. You can find everything we've got under the TMPT umbrella, including the Russo brand and the franchise Shane Douglas, the Triple Threat podcast. Every single week, it's the franchise's way, and we just follow and we listen to what he's got to say. And every time he opens his mouth, it's something impactful. So check that out. And of course, just like Kevin mentioned, eyes up here with the Queen of Extreme, Francine, patreon.com/Francine Podcast. 4 shows a week. You will not be disappointed by any of them because I'm on there. So how could you not be disappointed, right? Well, with all that being said, we will say goodbye for today. For the Shining Wizard himself, Mr. Kevin Garifo, this is your old buddy, the Chadster. We will catch you on the flip side.
Thanks for listening to the 2-Man Power Trip of Wrestling. What the World is Downloading.